content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service. And our first story today, Samaritan's Purse joins Gaza Humanitarian Foundation's aid efforts. This was written by Yonat Shimran. After struggling for months to find partners to help them deliver aid to Gaza, the embattled Gaza Humanitarian Foundation has picked up a collaborator, Samaritan's Purse, the international Christian disaster relief organization headed by the Reverend Franklin Graham. Since July 26, Samaritan's Purse has sent 8 relief flights for Gaza, carrying 169 tons of supplemental food packets that have been distributed through the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation's 4 Gaza-based hubs. In addition, Samaritan's Purse has sent a medical team of 6 nurses and paramedics to provide first aid treatment at these distribution sites, a spokesman for the organization confirmed. The GHF is a private Israel and U.S.-backed project staffed with U.S. security contractors and financed with $30 million in U.S. tax dollars and a matching commitment from Israel. It was created to displace the United Nations' various humanitarian relief efforts, which Israel has prevented from functioning. But since the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, or GHF, began its operations in mid-May, more than 1,400 unarmed Palestinian civilians have reportedly been killed by Israel Defense Forces while seeking food at or near the GHF distribution sites, known as safe distribution hubs, located in remote militarized zones. Aid groups and governments around the world have condemned the operation and accused it of violating humanitarian standards and putting civilians at risk at a time when the region is experiencing mass starvation. The GHF's chairman, the Reverend Johnny Moore, a prominent evangelical and a one-time faith advisor to President Donald Trump, has pleaded with various international aid groups to join the effort. Many faith-based aid groups, such as Catholic Relief Services, have expressed deep skepticism of GHF and its methods and have rejected collaborations with it. But Ken Isaacs, Vice President of Programs and Government Relations for Samaritan's Purse, said his organization, based in North Carolina, said he was satisfied with GHF's operations. I visited several Gaza Humanitarian Foundation sites and was impressed with how they were secured and the professionalism of the GHF staff, Isaac said. They are working in a very difficult situation, and I am grateful that Samaritan's Purse has the opportunity to collaborate with GHF and other partners. We want to help as many people as we can. GHF spokesperson said the outfit works with other non-governmental organizations, but declined to name them, saying, "Many are afraid to say so because of fear from Hamas." Israel's nearly 2-year war of retribution against Hamas in the Gaza Strip has killed 62,000 people and earned it international censure across the world, with leading human rights organizations concluding that Israel is engaged in a genocide. In early March, Israel cut off all aid for Gaza, a move that Israeli officials said was taken to pressure Hamas into making concessions in ceasefire talks. That cutoff ended in May, when the GHF began a limited distribution of aid in Gaza. It may have been too late. International observers said starvation had set in. The Gaza Health Ministry has said that at least 271 people, including 112 children, have died of starvation to date. International observers say that not enough aid is being allowed in, and that the distribution system is deeply flawed and unable to reach the poorest people who desperately need it. They call them secure distribution sites, said Alex DeWall, executive director of the World Peace Foundation at Tufts University and author of a book on mass starvation. Well, the people aren't secure. A lot of them get killed. But the rations aren't secure either. No voluntary agency would ever hand out food in this way. You simply don't know what's coming to get it, who's coming to get it, and people are getting multiple boxes because they're strong. The strongest get the most. On August 7th, Mike Huckabee, the U.S. ambassador to Israel, announced a U.S. plan to expand aid distribution operations in Gaza to as many as 16 points. But since then, Israel announced its plan to invade Gaza City, the most populous city in the Strip, forcing hundreds of thousands of residents to once again uproot themselves. It's not clear whether the expanded sites will be open during a full-scale military incursion of the type the government of Israel has now approved. A GHF spokesman said it recently piloted a direct-to-community distribution program. This is not the first time Samaritan's Purse has provided aid in this conflict. After the October 7, 2023 Hamas attack on Israel, Samaritan's Purse pledged 42 ambulances to Megan David Adom, Israel's National Emergency Medical Service. Of those, 22 have already been provided. In Gaza, it has also worked with other partners to provide Palestinians with medicine, shelter, materials, and clean water. A spokesperson added, "We anticipate being able to do more in the future." Next, New York City faith leaders look to coordinate as federal cuts strain pantries and soup kitchens. This was written by Fiona Murphy for the Religion News Service. About 300 faith leaders and community activists met this week in Manhattan to strategize how religious organizations can better address rising food insecurity in New York City, even as food pantries face federal funding cuts. On Wednesday morning, August 20th, religious leaders from across faiths gathered at the Salvation Army's Medford Hall for a food pantry and soup kitchen summit hosted by the Mayor's Office of Faith-Based and Community Partnerships in collaboration with New York Disaster Interfaith Services and the Salvation Army. The goal of the summit, according to the Office of Faith-Based and Community Partnerships, was to connect different faith-based food pantries and nonprofits across the city to facilitate networking, provide resources, and strengthen the city's response to food insecurity. To have faith-based organizations in this space, it's very important for New York City, said Pastor Guilford Monrose, a Brooklyn pastor and the executive director of the Mayor's Office of Faith-Based and Community Partners. Faith-based food pantries are the drivers. They don't have a lot of funding. They don't have a lot of resources, but they are very high on compassion and care for our community. Since February, when the Trump administration suspended the emergency food and shelter program, resources for faith-based food pantries have grown increasingly scarce. In April, the administration announced plans to cut half of all food shipments through the Emergency Food Assistance Program, a $500 million reduction that affects food banks nationwide. According to the New York City Governor's Office, these cuts would cost the state roughly 16 million pounds of U.S. Department of Agriculture foods this year, impacting faith-based pantries and soup kitchens in New York that directly rely on those supplies. Peter Gudaitis, executive director of NYDIS, said the impact of the loss in federal funding is already significant. One of the big challenges is the Trump administration has eliminated the emergency food and shelter program funding, Gudaitis said. A lot of the social service agencies in the city that did have emergency food assistance funding now don't have that funding anymore. He said that New York DIS and Islamic Relief USA are planning to open a new food bank in December to help fill the gap, with a focus on smaller, faith-based pantries. The initiative will also provide equipment, such as refrigerators, so pantries can safely store fresh produce and proteins. Gudaitis, who distributed a survey to hundreds of faith-based food pantries across the city to gauge their scale and needs, said that even smaller neighborhood congregations are providing staggering levels of support to the community. Out of the first 80 or so congregations that responded to our survey, they're feeding 40,000 people a week. So, if 80 congregations are feeding 40,000 people a week, and we have almost 700 signed up to be here today, you're talking about millions of meals a year provided through these small pantries. Larger faith-based providers like Holy Apostles Soup Kitchen in Chelsea or the Met Council's Kosher Pantry Network feed thousands each week. Together, these groups form a substantial portion of New York's food safety net and feel the strain of rising demand with dwindling resources. The government can't do what these faith-based organizations are doing, Monroe said. Government sucks at being compassionate in terms of underground and individuals. That's the truth. Because if government could have, then we wouldn't need our partners. They are the ones who really anchor us. Approximately 700 congregations across all five boroughs registered to participate in the two-hour summit, which consisted of a presentation and a panel featuring leaders from several food distribution organizations, including Jerome Nathaniel with City Harvest, one of the largest food suppliers in the state, Mohammed Razvi, founder and executive director of the Council of People's Organization, which operates one of the largest halal food pantries in Brooklyn, and Tara Walker, an official with the city's Community Food Connections Program, among other nonprofit directors. Where I used to get 6 pallets a week from Food Bank for New York City, now I'm only getting 2 pallets, Razvi said. Since COVID-19, COPO's operation has expanded from serving 60 people per week to currently providing food to about 30,000 families. A pallet, a 4x4 container used in bulk shipping, can carry more than 1,000 pounds of canned or fresh food. Alongside the food, Razvi said COPO has distributed thousands of go bags or emergency kits prepared in response to heightened fears of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement raids in the city. About 1 in 5 people he serves are immigrants, many of them Muslim, for whom having access to halal food is a necessity. Federal cuts to food pantry funding have pushed Razvi to get more resourceful in order to feed the large population he serves. Now, he said, I have to reach into my neighborhood, the grocery store owners or others who might have abundance of food, that they need to get rid of. Razvi said he is in the process of purchasing a refrigerated truck to travel around the city and pick up extra food. Patricia Davis, pastor of the Community Church of Christ in the Queensboro's Jamaica neighborhood, operates a food pantry once a week. She said she came to the summit in hopes of expanding her collaboration network. "We've learned that when churches come together, we can share resources and reach more people," Davis said. "Smaller pantries like hers, which serves around 100 people a week," she said, "feel the federal funding cuts more sharply than larger churches with bigger budgets. Our pantry lines keep getting longer, but our resources keep getting smaller." To adapt, her church recently adjusted its food pantry hours to better accommodate New Yorkers working 9-to-5 jobs. "For everybody, there's a sense of fear," Davis said. "It's not only just for people who are unhoused or people who are unemployed, but we have middle-class working people, families that are now on our food pantry lines." Winston Johnson, a member of the Rastafari community in Brooklyn, attended the summit. "We wanted to know what type of resources are here and whatever help we could get," Johnson said. He said the summit for him was successful as he feels more aware of resources, partnerships, and food suppliers in the city like City Harvest and COPO. Johnson's community, which follows a natural vegan diet, operated a food pantry before the pandemic, but after being unable to keep its brick-and-mortar space, the pantry was forced to close. Now, relocating to a new site, Johnson said the community is eager to restart the pantry, which previously served more than 300 people. "The information today has been useful," Johnson said. Monroe called Wednesday's gathering a great start. He said future summits may include hands-on training on how to run a food pantry, with participants divided by experience level, allowing more tailored results. "I believe the next one we will do, we will have specific training on how to run a successful food pantry," Monroe said. "I think the information is good, but I think we need to go down to the nuts and bolts." Our third story. To understand a faith, first understand the people who practice it. This is written by Simranjit Singh. Earlier this summer, I was in Salt Lake City on a production for Undivided, a planned new TV show about American religions that I'm hosting. In Salt Lake, I met with Latter-day Saints, known widely as Mormons, a term that some people view as pejorative. Some were queer, some were black, and many of these church members shared their stories of being doubly marginalized, first as religious minorities historically rejected by their fellow Americans, and then by people from their own community. Many Latter-day Saints of all stripes shared the strangeness of their position, seeing themselves as part of the American tapestry, yet never being fully accepted by the broader American society. A few mentioned how hard it is to be objects of American fascination with LDS culture. As if to prove their point, the New York Times recently published two articles while I was in Utah about the Latter-day Saints. One on the hit reality show, The Secret Lives of Mormon Wives, and the second about a newly approved religious undergarment that ran on the front page of the print edition. Both were examples of quality journalism, but neither misinforming readers nor misrepresenting the truth. Both brought interesting and important aspects of their stories to light, and yet I found myself reflecting on what one person said to me about life for people in the church. "It's almost like Americans are obsessed with us and what makes us weird. And I get that, but I wish people would actually get to know us." I'm grateful that the church's support for our production opened some doors for us to present a wider view of the LDS community than outsiders typically see, And further, I'm grateful for the numerous individual saints who shared vulnerability and honestly about their experiences and faith journeys. Those stories complicated my assumptions about the LDS community, and I'm sure they will for our audiences as well. Through all of these discussions, I re-encountered a lesson that life has taught me many times over. People are not who you assume them to be, and no one fits a textbook definition. To truly get to know one another and experience our shared humanity, we have to meet one another where we are and ask questions about what's important to us. A scholar of religion who comes from a minority religious experience, I've long advocated understanding any faith by trying to understand the people who practice it first. Even I forget that sometimes, letting my own biases and assumptions get in the way. As I look at how religion is dividing the United States, I feel the divide firsthand as a member of a Sikh community that was often targeted in bigotry, and I see a real urgency to this. A first step is to recognize how low our faith fluency is in the United States. That gap often plays out in media as misrepresentation and erasure. Why is it the case that for most Americans, our primary cultural touch points for Latter-day Saints is a Broadway musical comedy or a salacious reality show? Wouldn't we be much better off if we balanced those stories out with other portrayals that truly reflected the texture and diversity of the LDS community? Similarly, how is it that not a single TV show or movie that I can share centers the Sikh community, who practices the world's fifth largest religion? Our cultural ignorance has had violent consequences, from racist mobs rounding up and attacking Sikhs within the first few years of their arrival in the U.S., to white supremacists massacring Sikhs as they prayed in more recent years. I'm not suggesting that Hollywood can draw its next Brad Pitt or Julia Roberts from Sikh America, but a modicum of representation would go a long way in introducing the rest of America to the community and seeing its members as human beings who deserve dignity and respect as much as anyone else. A handful of shows have broken through precisely because they treat faith as real and complex. Rami, a Hulu series about a Muslim millennial born and raised in New Jersey, did an impeccable job of capturing what life looks like for a son of Muslim immigrants. It didn't exoticize religion or treat it as a set of rules that everyone follows perfectly. Instead, it depicts religion as I have known it, as an aspect of a complex human identity, one that offers all kinds of tensions and questions and funny situations, for better or worse. I was reminded of Rami as I sat among Latter-day Saints of all skin colors and ethnic backgrounds in Salt Lake. None of those contexts appeared in encyclopedic entries on the LDS Church, and yet they are the church in real life. Because of shows like Rami, audiences are increasingly sophisticated enough to see through the overly simplistic stories. I love Buddhist history and teach courses on it. Still, I'd be the first to admit that people don't want to read textbooks about Buddhism. We want to know who Buddhists are, what their lives are like. Audiences are hungry for authentic human stories with meaning, identity, joy, and real-life struggles people face, including challenges to mental and emotional health. Creators and producers would do well to consider faith as a visible storytelling tool for advancing those themes. I'm ready for a world in which we tell the stories of everyday people, like the ones I met in Utah. What I learned from them challenged my assumptions and opened my heart, creating enough space for me to connect with people I would have never connected with otherwise. And isn't that exactly what we need in our country right now? Next, why has Canada embraced euthanasia? This is written by Mark Silk. No country in the world has gone as far as Canada in enabling people to die if they want to. And a lot of Canadians want to. In 2023, the last year for which statistics are available, 15,343 of them had their lives terminated by way of the country's medical assistance in dying law, a nearly 5% of the total number of deaths in the country. In the September issue of The Atlantic magazine, staff writer Elena Plott Calabro reviews Canada's MAID experience within the bounds of reportorial balance, suggesting it is a bad thing. You can understand her qualms. 10 years ago, the Canadian Supreme Court overturned a criminal ban on medically assisted death. Initially, a person's natural demise had to be reasonably foreseeable to be considered, but in 2021, that requirement was removed. Individuals with chronic debilitating conditions whose death was not imminent were allowed to seek MAID under what was termed Track 2. So far as Calabro is concerned, the problem is that Canada has made the value of patient autonomy paramount, allowing Canada's MAID advocates to push for expansion in terms that brook no argument, refracted through the language of equality, access, and compulsion. This is the story of an ideology in motion, of what happens when a nation enshrines a right before reckoning with the totality of its logic. If autonomy in death is sacrosanct, is there anyone who shouldn't be helped to die? There's little question that the decline in religious belief has contributed significantly to the rise in the numbers of people seeking medical assistance in dying, not only in Canada, but in the small number of other countries that permit the practice. In the Netherlands, whose MAID law is similar to Canada's, the percentage of deaths has increased from 1.3% to 5.4% since its law went into effect in 2002. As the non-religious population rose from 40% to 56%. In Switzerland, where assisted suicide has been legal since 1942, the percentage of assisted suicide deaths has increased tenfold. In Canada, this is most striking in Quebec, where the abandonment of Catholicism by much of the population has resulted in, for example, 75% of Quebecers who now think abortion is acceptable, as opposed to 8% who think it isn't, making Quebec the most pro-choice province in the country. If the value of patient autonomy is backed up by the value of democratic decision-making, where does that leave the value of preserving life at all costs? No doubt, more safeguards, such as longer waiting periods and tougher permission standards, would reduce the number of medical assistance in dying cases in Canada, but these would run up against the views of the Canadian citizenry. I'm sorry I had to edit that last article due to time constraints. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, NC Reading Service.